Why did the political, economic, and ecological histories of these two countries sharing the same island unfold so differently? Part of the answer involves environmental differences. Hispaniola's rains come mainly from the east. Hence, the Dominican part of the island receives more rain and thus supports higher rates of plant growth. Hispaniola's highest mountains are on the Dominican side, and the rivers from those high mountains mainly flow eastwards into the Dominican side. The Dominican side has broad valleys, plains and plateaus, and much thicker soils. In contrast, the Haitian side is drier. A higher percentage of Haiti's area is mountainous. The area of flat land good for intensive agriculture is much smaller. There is more limestone terrain, and the soils are thinner and less fertile and have a lower capacity for recovery. While those environmental differences did contribute to the different trajectories of the two countries, a larger part of the explanation involved social and political differences. One of those differences involved the accident that Haiti was a colony of rich France, while the Dominican Republic was a colony of Spain, which by the late 1500s was an economic and political decline. Hence, France imported far more slaves into its colony than did Spain. As a result, Haiti has double the Republic's population density. The combination of that higher population density and lower rainfall was the main factor behind the more rapid deforestation and loss of soil fertility on the Haitian side. In addition, all of those French ships that brought slaves to Haiti returned to Europe with cargoes of Haitian timber, so that Haiti's lowlands and mid-mountain slopes had been largely stripped of timber by the mid-19th century. A second social and political factor is that the Dominican Republic was both more receptive and more attractive to European immigrants and investors. Those Dominican immigrants included many middle-class business people and skilled professionals who contributed to the country's development. Still another social difference is that, as a legacy of their country's slave history and revolt, most Haitians owned their own land, used it to feed themselves, and received no help from their government in developing cash crops for trade overseas. While the Dominican Republic eventually did develop an export economy and overseas trade. A recent cause of divergence lies in the differing aspirations of the two dictators. Trujillo sought to develop industrial economy and modern state, but Duvalier did not. Finally, because the Dominican Republic retained much forest cover and began to industrialize, the Trujillo regime initially planned, and subsequent presidents constructed, dams to generate hydroelectric power. Balaguer launched a crass program to spare forest use for fuel by importing propane and liquefied natural gas, but Haiti's poverty forced its people to remain dependent on forest-derived charcoal for fuel, thereby accelerating the destruction of its last remaining forests. What about the Dominican Republic's own environmental problems, and what about the countermeasures that it adopted? Bottom-up environmental protection was launched in a serious way between 1919 and 1930. In the area around Santiago, the second largest city and the center of the richest and most heavily exploited agricultural area. The lawyer Juan Bautista Pérez Rancier and the physician and surveyor Miguel Canela y Lázaro lobbied the Santiago Chamber of Commerce to buy land as a forest reserve, and they also sought to raise the necessary funds by public subscription. Success was achieved in 1927 when the Republic's Secretary of Agriculture contributed additional government funds to make possible the purchase of the first natural reserve, the Vedado del Yaque. The Yaque River is the country's largest river, and a vedado is an area of land to which entry is controlled or forbidden. After 1930, the dictator Trujillo shifted the impetus for environmental management to a top-down approach. His regime expanded the area of the Vedado del Yaque, created other vedados, established in 1934 the first national park, set up a corps of forest guards to enforce protection of forests, suppressed the wasteful use of fire to burn forest in order to clear land for agriculture, and banned the cutting of pine trees without his permission in the area around Constanza. Trujillo undertook these measures in the name of environmental protection. But he was probably motivated more strongly by his own personal economic advantage. He himself came to own large areas of pine forest, and to be the joint owner of the country's main sawmills. Trujillo's foresters adopted the environmentally sound measure of leaving some mature trees standing as sources of seed for natural reforestation, and those big old trees can still be recognized today in the regenerated forest. Environmental measures under Trujillo in the 1950s included the planning of hydroelectric dams and the establishment of more national parks. Under his dictatorship, Trujillo carried out extensive logging himself, but his government prevented others from logging. After his death in 1961, that wall against widespread pillaging of the Dominican environment fell. Squatters occupied land and used forest fires to clear woodlands for agriculture. A disorganized large-scale immigration from the countryside into urban barrios sprung up, and four wealthy families of the Santiago area began logging at a rate faster than the rate under Trujillo. 2 years after Trujillo's death, the democratically elected president Juan Bosch attempted to persuade loggers to spare the pine forests so that they could remain as watersheds for the planned Yaque and Nizao dams. But the loggers instead joined with other interests to overthrow Bosch. Rates of logging accelerated until the election of Joaquin Balaguer as president in 1966. Balaguer recognized the country's urgent need for maintaining forested watersheds. Soon after becoming president, he took drastic action by banning all commercial logging in the country and by closing all of the country's sawmills. That action provoked strong resistance by rich, powerful families, who responded by pulling back their logging operations into more remote areas of forests and by operating their sawmills at night. Balaguer reacted by taking responsibility for enforcing forest protection away from the Department of Agriculture and turning it over to the armed forces. The armed forces initiated a program of survey flights and military operations, which climaxed in 1967 in a night raid by the military on a clandestine large logging camp. In the ensuing gunfight, a dozen loggers were killed. That strong signal served as a shock to the loggers. While some illegal logging continued, it was met with further raids and shootings of loggers, and it decreased greatly during Balaguer's first period as president. During the 8 years when Balaguer was out of office from 1978 to 1986, other presidents reopened some logging camps and sawmills and allowed charcoal production from forests to increase. On the first day of his return to the presidency in 1986, Balaguer began issuing executive orders to close logging camps and sawmills again. Military operations resumed to capture and imprison loggers and to remove poor squatters, plus rich agribusinesses and mansions from the parks. He opened the market to wood imports, and he reduced traditional charcoal production from trees, the curse of Haiti, by contracting for liquefied natural gas imports from Venezuela, subsidizing the cost of gas to the public, and calling for the distribution without cost of propane stoves and cylinders in order to encourage people to shift from charcoal. He greatly expanded the natural reserve system, added 2 humpback whale sanctuaries, protected land within 20 yards of rivers and within 60 yards of the coast, protected wetlands, and banned hunting for 10 years. He put pressure on industries to treat their wastes, launched with limited success some efforts to control air pollution, and slapped a big tax on mining companies. In Santo Domingo, he founded the aquarium, the botanical garden, and the Natural History Museum, and rebuilt the National Zoo, all of which have become major attractions. To many of us, it is difficult to reconcile that apparently strong and far-sighted commitment to the environment with his repellent qualities. Balaguer operated his own squads of thugs to assassinate hundreds or perhaps thousands of the opposition. He tolerated widespread corruption. Among the quotes attributed to him is, "The Constitution is nothing more than a piece of paper." In light of that history of environmental impacts in the Dominican Republic, what is the current status of the country's environmental problems and of its natural reserve system? The exodus of Dominicans from rural areas to the cities and overseas has decreased pressure on the forest, but deforestation is continuing, especially near the Haitian border, where desperate Haitians cross the border to fell trees for making charcoal and clear land to farm as squatters. In the year 2000, the enforcement of forest protection reverted from the armed forces to the Ministry of the Environment, which is weaker and lacks the necessary funds, so that forest protection is now less effective. Along most of the Republic's coastline, marine habitats and coral reefs have been heavily damaged and overfished. Soil loss by erosion on deforested land has been massive. Salinization has developed in some irrigated areas. Water quality in the country's rivers is now very poor because of sediment buildup from erosion, as well as toxic pollution and waste disposal. Industries dump their wastes into streams, as do residents of urban barrios with inadequate or non-existent public waste disposal. Beginning in the 1970s, there have been massive applications of toxic pesticides, insecticides, and herbicides in rich agricultural areas. The Dominican Republic has continued to use toxins that were banned in their overseas countries of manufacture long ago. That use has been tolerated by the government because Dominican agriculture is so profitable. Both Santo Domingo and Santiago have smog resulting from mass transit using obsolete vehicles, increased energy consumption, and the abundance of private generators that people maintain in their homes and businesses because of the frequent power failures. In order to reforest logged lands and hurricane-damaged lands in recent decades, the country has resorted to alien tree species that grow more quickly than does the native Dominican pine. They raise concern because some of them are prone to diseases to which the native Dominican pine is resistant, so that reforested slopes could lose their cover again if their trees are attacked by disease. While the country's rate of population increase has decreased, it is estimated as still around 1.6% per year. More serious than the country's growing population is its rapidly growing per capita human impact. By that term, I mean the average resource consumption and waste production of one person. The country is becoming increasingly dedicated to a consumerism that is not supported by the economy of the Dominican Republic itself, and that depends partly on earnings sent home by Dominicans working overseas. All of those people acquiring large amounts of consumer products are putting out correspondingly large amounts of wastes that overwhelm municipal waste disposal systems. One can see the trash accumulating in the streams, along city streets, and in the countryside. As one Dominican said to me, "The apocalypse here will not take the form of an earthquake or a hurricane, but of a world buried in garbage." What about the future of the Dominican Republic? Will the natural reserve system survive under the pressures that it faces? Is there hope for the country? On these questions, I encountered divergence of opinion among even my Dominican friends. Reasons for environmental pessimism begin with the fact that the reserve system is no longer backed by the iron fist of Joaquin Balaguer. It is underfunded, underpoliced, and has been only weakly supported by recent presidents, some of whom have tried to trim its area or even to sell it. On the other hand, a major reason for environmental optimism is the country's growing, well-organized, bottom-up environmental movement that is almost unprecedented in the developing world. The Dominican environmental movement is as determined and effective as in any other country with which I am familiar. Thus, as elsewhere in the world, I see in the Dominican Republic what one friend described as an exponentially accelerating horse race of unpredictable outcome between destructive and constructive forces. Both the threats to the environment and the environmental movement opposing those threats are gathering strength in the Dominican Republic, and we cannot foresee which will eventually prevail. Similarly, the prospects of the country's economy and society arouse divergence of opinion. Five of my Dominican friends are now deeply pessimistic. They feel the Dominican Republic is slipping downhill in the direction of Haiti's grinding desperation, but it is slipping more rapidly than Haiti did. Others of my Dominican friends respond that they have seen governments come and go over the last 40 years. Yes, the current government is especially weak and corrupt, but it will surely lose the next election. The Dominican Republic is a small country in which environmental problems become readily visible to everybody. It is also a face-to-face society, where concerned private individuals have ready access to government ministers. Perhaps most important of all, one has to remember that the Dominican Republic is a resilient country that has survived a history of problems far more daunting than its present ones. What about the future of Haiti? Already the poorest and one of the most overcrowded countries in the New World, Haiti is nevertheless continuing to become even poorer and more crowded, with a population growth rate of nearly 3% per year. Haiti is so poor and so deficient in natural resources and in trained or educated human resources that it really is difficult to see what might bring about improvement. Haiti even lacks the capacity to utilize outside assistance effectively. Might the Dominican Republic play a constructive role in Haiti's future? At first glance, the Republic looks like a very unlikely source of solutions to Haiti's problems. The Republic is poor and has enough problems helping its own citizens. There is a long, deeply rooted tradition of antagonism on both sides, with many Dominicans viewing Haiti as part of Africa and looking down on Haitians, and with many Haitians in turn suspicious of foreign meddling. Today, there is little collaboration between the two governments, which tend to view each other warily or with hostility. But none of these considerations changes two fundamental facts: that the Dominican environment merges continuously into the Haitian environment, and that Haiti is the country with the strongest effect upon the Dominican Republic. If the lot of Haiti is to improve at all, I don't see how that could happen without more involvement on the part of the Dominican Republic, even though that is almost unthinkable to most Dominicans today. While the Republic's own resources are scarce, at minimum, it could assume a larger role as a bridge in ways to be explored between the outside world and Haiti. China is the world's most populous country, with about 1.3 billion people, or one-fifth of the world's total. In area, it is the third largest country, and in plant species diversity, the third richest. Its economy, already huge, is growing at the fastest rate of any major country, nearly 10% per year, which is four times the growth rate of first world economies. It has the world's highest production rate of steel, cement, aquacultured food, and television sets, both the highest production and the highest consumption of coal, fertilizers, and tobacco. It stands near the top in production of electricity, and soon, motor vehicles, and in consumption of timber. And it is now building the world's largest dam and largest water diversion project. Marring these superlatives and achievements, China's environmental problems are among the most severe of any major country, and are getting worse. The long list ranges from air pollution, biodiversity losses, cropland losses, desertification, disappearing wetlands, grassland degradation, and increasing scale and frequency of human-induced natural disasters to invasive species, overgrazing, river flow cessation, salinization, soil erosion, trash accumulation, and water pollution and shortages. These and other environmental problems are causing enormous economic losses, social conflicts, and health problems within China. All these considerations alone would suffice to make the impact of China's environmental problems on the Chinese people a subject of major concern. But China's large population, economy, and area also guarantee that its environmental problems will spill over to the rest of the world, which is increasingly affected through sharing the same planet with China. The Chinese environment is complex. Its diverse geography includes the world's largest and highest plateau, some of the world's highest mountains, two of the world's longest rivers, many lakes, a long coastline, and large continental shelf. Its diverse habitats range from glaciers and deserts to tropical rainforests. Within those ecosystems lie areas fragile for different reasons. For example, northern China has highly variable rainfall, plus simultaneous occurrences of winds and droughts that make its high-altitude grasslands susceptible to dust storms and soil erosion, while southern China has heavy rainstorms that cause erosion on slopes. As for China's population, the two best-known facts about it are that it is the world's largest and that the Chinese government uniquely in the modern world, instituted mandatory fertility control that dramatically decreased the population growth rate to 1.3% per year by the year 2001. Less well known, but with significant consequences for China's human impacts, is that the number of China's households has nevertheless been growing at 3.5% per year over the last 15 years, more than double the growth rate of its population. That's because household size decreased from 4.5 people per house in 1985 to 3.5 in 2000 and is projected to decrease further to 2.7 by the year 2015. At the same time, per capita floor area per house increased by nearly threefold. The net result is that China's human impact is increasing despite its low population growth rate. The remaining feature of China's population trends worth stressing is rapid urbanization. From 1953 to 2001, while China's total population doubled, the percentage of its population that is urban tripled, from 13 to 38%. With increasing affluence, demand for beef, lamb, and chicken products has increased rapidly, to the point where per capita egg consumption now equals that of the first world. Per capita consumption of meat, eggs, and milk increased fourfold between 1978 and 2001. That means much more agricultural waste, because it takes 10 or 20 pounds of plants to produce 1 pound of meat. The annual output of animal droppings on land is already three times the output of industrial solid wastes. China's transportation network and vehicle fleet have grown explosively. In 1994, China decided to make car production one of its four so-called pillar industries, with the goal of increasing production by a factor of four by the year 2010. That would make China the world's third-largest vehicle manufacturing country, after the U.S. and Japan. Behind the impressive statistics on the scale and growth of China's economy lurks the fact that much of it is based on outdated, inefficient, or polluting technology. China's energy efficiency in industrial production is only half that of the first world. Its paper production consumes more than twice as much water as in the first world, and its irrigation relies on inefficient surface methods. Three-quarters of China's energy consumption depends on coal, the main cause of its air pollution and acid rain, and a significant cause of inefficiency. China's environmental problems can be summarized under six main headings: air, water, soil, habitat destruction, biodiversity losses, and mega projects. To begin with China's most notorious pollution problem, its air quality is dreadful, symbolized by now familiar photographs of people having to wear face masks on the streets of many Chinese cities. Air pollution in some major cities is the worst in the world, with pollutant levels several times higher than considered safe. Acid rain has spread over much of the country and is now experienced in one quarter of Chinese cities for more than half of the rainy days each year. Similarly, water quality in most Chinese rivers and groundwater sources is poor and declining due to industrial and municipal wastewater discharges and runoffs of fertilizers, pesticides, and manure. The famous Guanteng Reservoir in Beijing was declared unsuitable for drinking in 1997. Only 20% of domestic wastewater is treated, as compared to 80% in the first world. Those water problems are exacerbated by shortages and waste. By world standards, China is poor in fresh water, with a quantity per person only one quarter of the world average value. That underlying water shortage, plus wasteful use, causes over 100 cities to suffer from severe water shortages and occasionally even halts industrial production. Of the water required for cities and for irrigation, two-thirds depends on groundwater pumped from wells tapping aquifers. However, those aquifers are becoming depleted, permitting seawater to enter them in most coastal areas, and causing land to sink under some cities as the aquifers are becoming emptied. China also already has the world's worst problem of cessation of river flows, and that problem is becoming much worse because water continues to be drawn from rivers for use. China is one of the countries most severely damaged by erosion, now affecting 19% of its land area and resulting in soil loss at 5 billion tons per year. Soil quality and fertility, as well as soil quantity, have declined, partly because of long-term fertilizer use, plus pesticide-related drastic declines in soil-renewing earthworms. Desertification due to overgrazing and land reclamation for agriculture has affected more than one quarter of China. These soil problems have joined urbanization and land appropriation for mining, forestry, and aquaculture in reducing China's area of cropland. That poses a big problem for China's food security, because at the same time as its cropland has been declining, its population and per capita food consumption have been increasing. Cropland per person is now only 1 hectare, nearly as low as the value for northwest Rwanda. In addition, because China recycles very little trash, huge quantities of industrial and domestic trash are dumped into open fields, polluting soil and taking over or damaging cropland. More than two-thirds of China's cities are now surrounded by trash, whose composition has changed dramatically from vegetable leftovers, dust, and coal residues to plastics, glass, metal, and wrapping paper. China is one of the world's most forest-poor countries, with forests covering only 16% of the land area. While government efforts have increased the area of single-species tree plantations and thereby slightly increased the total area considered forested, natural forests, especially old-growth forests, have been shrinking. That deforestation is a major contributor to China's soil erosion and floods. After the Great Floods of 1996 had caused $25 billion of damages, the even bigger 1998 floods shocked the government into banning any further logging of natural forests. Along with climate change, deforestation has probably contributed to China's increasing frequency of droughts, which now affect 30% of its cropland each year. The other two most serious forms of habitat destruction in China, besides deforestation, are destruction or degradation of grasslands and wetlands. China is second only to Australia in the extent of its natural grasslands, which cover 40% of its area. China's grasslands have been subject to severe damage by overgrazing, climate change, and mining and other types of development, so that 90% are now considered degraded. That degradation has implications extending beyond China, because China's grasslands of the Tibetan Plateau are the headwaters for major rivers of India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam, as well as of China. Wetlands have been decreasing in area. Their water level has been fluctuating greatly. Their capacity to mitigate floods and to store water has decreased, and wetland species have become endangered or extinct. Other biodiversity losses with big economic consequences include the severe degradation of both freshwater and coastal marine fisheries by overfishing and pollution, because fish consumption is rising with growing affluence. As a result, the white sturgeon has been pushed to the brink of extinction. The formerly robust Bohai prawn harvest declined 90%. Formerly abundant fish species must now be imported. The annual take of wild fish in the Yangtze River has declined 75%, and that river had to be closed to fishing for the first time ever in 2003. More generally, China's biodiversity is very high, with over 10% of the world's plant and terrestrial vertebrate species. However, about one-fifth of China's native species, including the giant panda, are now endangered, and many other distinctive rare ones, such as Chinese alligators and ginkgos, are already at risk of extinction. The flip side of these declines has been a rise in invasive species. China has had a long history of intentionally introducing species considered beneficial. Now, with the recent 60-fold increase in international trade, those intentional introductions are being joined by accidental introductions of many species that no one would consider beneficial. Some of those invasive plants, insects, and fish have gone on to establish themselves as pests and weeds, causing huge economic damage to Chinese agriculture, aquaculture, forestry, and livestock production. If all that were not enough, underway in China are the world's largest development projects, all expected to cause severe environmental problems. The Three Gorges Dam of the Yangtze River, the world's largest dam, projected for completion in 2009, aims to provide electricity, flood control, and improve navigation at a financial cost of $30 billion, social costs of uprooting millions of people and environmental costs associated with disruption of the world's third longest river. Still more expensive is a south-to-north water diversion project, which began in 2002, is not scheduled for completion until around 2050, and is projected to cost $59 billion. Even that project will be exceeded by the projected development of Western China, making up over half of the country's land area and viewed by China's leaders as the key to national development. Even if China's people had no connection through trade and travel with people elsewhere, China's large territory and population would guarantee effects on other peoples merely because China is releasing its wastes and gases into the same ocean and atmosphere. But China's connections to the rest of the world through trade, investment, and foreign aid have been accelerating almost exponentially in the last two decades. Let's now consider other ways in which the rest of the world influences China, then how China influences the rest of the world. The interconnectedness of societies in today's world causes some of the most important differences between how environmental problems played out in the past and how they play out today. Among the bad things that China receives from the rest of the world, I already mentioned economically damaging invasive species. Another large-scale import that will surprise many listeners is garbage. Some first-world countries reduce their mountains of garbage by paying China to accept untreated garbage, including wastes containing toxic chemicals. In addition, China's expanding manufacturing economy and industries accept garbage scrap that could serve as cheap sources of recoverable raw materials. This represents direct transfer of pollution from the first world to China. Even worse than garbage, foreign companies have transferred pollution-intensive industries to China, including technologies now illegal in the country of origin. As of 1995, China was home to an estimated 16,998 pollution-intensive firms. Turning now from China's imports to its exports in a broad sense, China's high native biodiversity means that China gives back to other countries many invasive species. For instance, the three best-known pests that have wiped out numerous North American tree populations, the chestnut blight, the misnamed Dutch elm disease, and the Asian long-horned beetle, all originated in China or else somewhere nearby in East Asia. Another species which China is exporting in increasing numbers is Homo sapiens. China has now moved into third place as a source of legal immigration into Australia, and significant numbers of illegal as well as legal immigrants crossing the Pacific Ocean reach even the U.S. While Chinese insects and people reach overseas countries by ship and plane, other exports arrive in the atmosphere. China became the world's largest producer and consumer of gaseous ozone-depleting substances, such as chlorofluorocarbons, after first-world countries phased them out in 1995. China also now contributes 12% of the world's carbon dioxide emissions that play a major role in global warming. If current trends continue, China will become the world's leader in carbon dioxide emissions, accounting for 40% of the world's total by the year 2050. China already leads the world in production of sulfur oxides, with an output double that of the U.S. Propelled eastwards by winds, the pollutant-laden dust, sand, and soil originating from China gets blown to Korea, Japan, Pacific Islands, and across the Pacific within a week to the U.S. and Canada. Those aerial particles are the result of China's coal-burning economy, deforestation, overgrazing, erosion, and destructive agricultural methods. The next exchange between China and other countries involves an import doubling as an export. Imported timber, hence exported deforestation. China ranks third in the world in timber consumption, but a growing gap has been developing between China's increasing demand for wood products and its declining domestic supply. Hence, China's wood imports have increased sixfold since the ban. With China's entrance into the World Trade Organization, those timber imports are expected to increase even more, because tariffs on wood products are about to be reduced. In effect, this means that China, like Japan, will be exporting deforestation to other countries, several of which have already reached or are on the road to catastrophic deforestation. Potentially more important than all of these other impacts is a rarely discussed consequence of the aspirations of China's people to a first-world lifestyle. If China's per capita consumption rates rise to first-world levels, and even if nothing else about the world changed, then that rate increase alone would translate into an increase in total world production consumption by 94% in the case of industrial metals. In other words, China's achievement of first-world standards will approximately double the entire world's human resource use and environmental impact. But it is doubtful whether even the world's current human resource use and impact can be sustained. Something has to give way. That is the strongest reason why China's problems automatically become the world's problems. What does the future hold for China? All that one can say for sure is that things will get worse before they get better, because of time lags and the momentum of damage already underway. One big factor acting both for the worse and for the better is the anticipated increase in China's international trade as a result of its joining the WTO, thereby lowering or abolishing tariffs and increasing exports and imports of cars, textiles, agricultural products, and many other commodities. Already, China's export industries tend to send manufactured finished products overseas and to leave in China the pollutants involved in the manufacture. There will presumably now be more of that. Some of China's imports, such as garbage and cars, have already been bad for the environment. There may be more of that, too. On the other hand, some countries belonging to the WTO adhere to environmental standards much stricter than China's, and that will force China to adopt those international standards as a condition of its exports being admitted by those countries. More agricultural imports may permit China to decrease its use of fertilizers, pesticides, and low-productivity cropland, while importation of oil and natural gas will let China decrease pollution from its burning of coals. A two-edged consequence of WTO membership may be that, by increasing imports and thereby decreasing Chinese domestic production, it will merely enable China to transfer environmental damage from China itself to overseas. Offsetting all the discouraging signs, there are also important promising signs. Both WTO membership and the impending 2008 Olympic Games in China have spurred the Chinese government to pay more attention to environmental problems. For instance, a $6 billion green wall or tree belt is now under development around Beijing to protect the city against dust and sandstorms. To reduce air pollution in Beijing, its city government ordered that motor vehicles be converted to permit the use of natural gas and liquefied petroleum gas. China phased out lead in gasoline in little more than a year, something that Europe and the U.S. took many years to achieve. New cars are required to meet exacting emission standards prevailing in Europe. China is already making a big effort to protect its outstanding biodiversity, with 1,757 nature reserves covering 13% of its land area, not to mention all of its zoos, botanical gardens, wildlife breeding centers, museums, and gene and cell banks. China uses some distinctive, environmentally friendly, traditional technologies on a large scale, such as the South Chinese practice of raising fish in irrigated rice fields. Encouraging signs in reforestation are the initiation of major tree plantations and the national ban on logging. Since 1990, China has combated desertification on 15,000 square miles of land by reforestation and fixation of sand dunes. The Grain to Green program, begun in 2000, gives subsidies to farmers who convert cropland to forest or grassland, and is thereby reducing the use of environmentally sensitive steep hillsides for agriculture. How will it all end up? Like the rest of the world, China is lurching between accelerating environmental damage and accelerating environmental protection. China's large population and large growing economy, and its current and historic centralization, mean that China's lurches involve more momentum than those of any other country. The outcome will affect not just China, but the whole world as well. Because of China's size and its unique form of government, top-down decision-making has operated on a far larger scale there than anywhere else. My best-case scenario for the future is that China's government will recognize that its environmental problems pose an even graver threat than did its problem of population growth. It may then conclude that China's interests require environmental policies as bold and as effectively carried out as its family planning policies. Mining in the literal sense, coal, iron, and so on, is a key to Australia's economy today by providing the largest share of its export earnings. In a metaphorical sense, however, mining is also a key to Australia's environmental history and to its current predicament. That's because the essence of mining is to exploit resources that do not renew themselves with time, and hence to deplete those resources. Mining minerals may thus be contrasted with exploiting renewable resources, such as forests, fish, and topsoil that do regenerate themselves. Renewable resources can be exploited indefinitely, provided that one removes them at a rate less than the rate at which they regenerate. If, however, one exploits forest, fish, or topsoil at rates exceeding their renewal rates, they too will eventually be depleted to extinction, like gold in a gold mine. Australia has been and still is mining its renewable resources as if they were minerals, that is, faster than their renewal rates, with the result that they are declining. At present rates, Australia's forests and fisheries will disappear long before its coal and iron reserves. While many other countries today besides Australia are mining their environments, Australia is an especially suitable choice for this final case study of past and present societies for several reasons. It is a first-world country, unlike Rwanda, Haiti, the Dominican Republic, and China. Among first-world countries, its population and economy are much smaller and less complex than are those of the U.S., Europe, or Japan, so the Australian situation is more easily grasped. Ecologically, the Australian environment is exceptionally fragile, the most fragile of any first-world country except perhaps Iceland. As a consequence, many problems that could eventually become crippling in other first-world countries, such as overgrazing, salinization, soil erosion, introduced species, water shortages, and man-made droughts, have already become severe in Australia. That is, while Australia shows no prospects of collapsing, it gives us a foretaste of problems that actually will arise elsewhere in the first world if present trends continue. Yet Australia's prospects for solving those problems give me hope and are not depressing. Then, too, Australia has a well-educated populace, a high standard of living, and relatively honest political and economic institutions by world standards. Hence, Australia's environmental problems cannot be dismissed as products of ecological mismanagement by an uneducated, desperately impoverished populace and grossly corrupt government and businesses, as one might perhaps be inclined to explain away environmental problems in some other countries. Australia illustrates strongly the five factors whose interplay I have identified throughout this book as useful for understanding possible ecological declines or collapses of societies. Humans have had obvious massive impacts on the Australian environment. Climate change is exacerbating those impacts today. Australia's friendly relations with Britain as a trade partner and model society have shaped Australian environmental and population policies. While modern Australia has not been invaded by outside enemies, the perception of actual and potential enemies has shaped Australian environmental and population policies. Australia also displays the importance of cultural values, including some imported ones that could be viewed as inappropriate to the Australian landscape, for understanding environmental impacts. Perhaps more than any other first world citizens known to me, Australians are beginning to think radically about the central question: which of our traditional core values can we retain, and which ones instead no longer serve us well in today's world? For purposes of understanding modern human impacts on the Australian environment, three features of that environment are particularly important: Australian soils, availability of fresh water, and distances, both within Australia and also between Australia and its overseas trading partners and potential enemies. When one starts to think of Australian environmental problems, the first thing that comes to mind is its water shortage and deserts. In fact, Australia's soils have caused even bigger problems than has its water availability. Australia is the most unproductive continent, the one whose soils have on the average the lowest nutrient levels, the lowest plant growth rates, and the lowest productivity. That's because Australian soils are mostly so old that they have become leached of their nutrients by rain over the course of billions of years. Soils that have been leached of nutrients can have their nutrient levels renewed by three major processes, all of which have been deficient in Australia compared to other continents. First, nutrients can be renewed by volcanic eruptions, spewing fresh material from within the earth onto the earth's surface. Only a few small areas of eastern Australia have had volcanic activity within the last 100 million years. Second, advances and retreats of glaciers redeposit the earth's crust, and those soils redeposited tend to be fertile. Less than 1% of the Australian mainland has been glaciated within the last 1 million years. Just about 20 square miles, plus 1,000 square miles of the offshore island of Tasmania. Finally, slow uplift of crust also brings up new soils. However, only a few small areas of Australia have been uplifted within the last 100 million years. Those small fractions of the Australian landscape that have recently had their soils renewed by volcanism, glaciation, or uplift contribute disproportionately to modern Australia's agricultural productivity. The low average productivity of Australian soils has had major economic consequences for Australian agriculture, forestry, and fisheries. Such nutrients as were present at the onset of European agriculture quickly became exhausted. Thereafter, nutrients have had to be supplied artificially in the form of fertilizer, thus increasing agricultural production costs compared to those in more fertile soils overseas. Low soil productivity means low growth rates and low average yields of crops. Hence, a larger area of land has to be cultivated in Australia than elsewhere to obtain equivalent crop yields, so that fuel costs for agricultural machinery also tend to be relatively high. An extreme case of infertile soils occurs in southwestern Australia, Australia's so-called wheat belt, and one of its most valuable agricultural areas, where wheat is grown on sandy soils leached of nutrients, and essentially all nutrients must be added artificially as fertilizer. As a result of the extra expenses for Australian agriculture, Australian farmers sometimes cannot compete against overseas growers. For example, with modern globalization, it is cheaper to grow oranges in Brazil and ship the resulting orange juice concentrate 8,000 miles to Australia than to buy orange juice produced from Australian citrus trees. The same is true of Canadian pork and bacon compared to their Australian equivalents. Only in some specialized niche markets, that is, crops and animal products with high added value beyond ordinary growing costs, such as wine, can Australian farmers compete successfully in overseas markets. A second economic consequence of low Australian soil productivity involves agroforestry. In Australian forests, most of the nutrients are actually in the trees themselves, not in the soils. Hence, when the native forests have been cut down, and when modern Australians had either logged the regrowing natural forests or invested in agroforestry by establishing tree plantations, tree growth rates have been low in Australia compared to those in other timber-producing countries. The third consequence surprised me. One doesn't immediately think of fisheries as dependent on soil productivity. However, all of the nutrients in rivers, and at least some of those in oceans near the coastline, come from the soils drained by the rivers and then carried out into the ocean. Hence, Australia's rivers and coastal waters are also relatively unproductive, with the result that Australia's fisheries have been quickly mined. One Australian marine fishery after another has been overfished to the point of becoming uneconomic, often within just a few years of the fishery's discovery. Today, out of the nearly 200 countries in the world, Australia has the third largest exclusive marine zone surrounding it, but it ranks only 55th among the world's countries in the value of its marine fisheries, while the value of its freshwater fisheries is now negligible. A further feature of Australia's low soil productivity is that the problem was not perceptible to the first European settlers. Instead, they were deceived by appearances into thinking that the land was highly productive. But after loggers had removed the first standing crop of trees, and after sheep had grazed the standing crop of grass, the settlers were surprised to discover that trees and grass grew back very slowly, that the land was agriculturally uneconomic, and that in many areas it had to be abandoned after farmers and pastoralists had made big capital investments in building homes, fences, and buildings, and making other agricultural improvements. All those economic problems of Australian agriculture, forestry, fisheries, and failed land development are consequences of the low productivity of Australian soils. The other big problem of Australia's soils is that in many areas they are not only low in nutrients, but also high in salt. Some Australian soils contain more than 200 pounds of salt per square yard of surface area. Just as Australia's first farmers, without modern analysis of soil chemistry, could not be aware of the nutrient poverty of Australian soils, they similarly could not be aware of all that salt in the ground.